Hello, this is Paul Green, chairman of the City Club of Chicago and WGN political analyst. Today at the City Club, we have Howard Tolman, the CEO of 1871, the startup operation in the Merchandise Mart, where many, many young people and somewhat older people go to try and create the new technology of tomorrow. Tolman said, in effect, they have created 425 startups. They have 20,000 visitors a month who comes to 1871, including all the presidential candidates. They basically have a system there where everyone is on the cutting edge, and his motto is, in the modern age, the fast eat the slow.
I'm excited to be here, and I want to take a few minutes to tell you about 1871 and give you sort of an update, and then talk about trends and things that are really going to change the way businesses operate going forward in our lives, and then a little bit about innovation, which is something that we spend a great deal of time about. So first, with respect to 1871, about 425 companies now. We do 1,000 events a year at 1871 in the facility, which has grown now to about 125,000 square feet in the Merchandise Mart. The good news is the Mart has about 4.3 million square feet, so we have a little room to go. But not much, because one of the things that has happened since 1871, started in 2012, has been this enormous migration from the suburbs, from other places, to come to the city and sort of to the hub of technology for the whole Midwest. So we're excited about that. We have this year a group of mentors that will deliver more than 7,000 hours of one-on-one coaching, all volunteers, coaching for our members. And so that's an exciting part of what goes on, just a small part. The mentors are interesting because we have sort of a rule, and the rule is you need to actually know what the fuck you're talking about, all right? It just seemed like a good thing at the time. And so surgeons, you know, who talk about it, not as impressive as surgeons who do it. And speaking of surgeons, you know that you're sort of in really super shape when the New Yorker does a cartoon. What this says is, I'm afraid that kidney went to somebody who can code. So that's where we're headed. Bottom line is we want people there who've been there, who can help our companies grow. Our sole mission is really jobs and the creation of sustainable businesses and jobs. Today, what's interesting is you go to any school, any place in the world, and everybody wants to be an entrepreneur. Not everybody is going to be in that job description, but everybody increasingly is going to have to be entrepreneurial. It's just the way the world works. And entrepreneurs are sadly deluded people, but very enthusiastic. And, you know, the ignorance sort of is a competitive advantage, because if they knew how hard it was, or how long it takes, or how challenging it can be, maybe they wouldn't do it. But to date, about 1,800 people show up every single day at 1871. We have enormous support from sponsors, enormous supports from all the universities in the city. We are now international, so that we have reciprocity, actually completely selfish. We want these companies to come to the United States. But with Mexico City and Toronto and Paris and London and Tel Aviv and Brazil and Colombia and Turkey and growing. And so about 20,000 people a month now come to 1871. Tech tourism is exploding, and it's a great way of putting the city's story not on just on the U.S. map, but really on the world map. It's so busy that our new stairway, we've actually had to divide it. I know the city council is talking about making it illegal to text when you walk. So we actually have three lanes. We have a texting lane, we have a running lane, and a walking lane. It's worked out really well for us. Now, the other thing that people don't exactly understand is this is not an age thing. We certainly have newbies, but what's so exciting is that we have career changers. We have serial entrepreneurs, and the most exciting thing are folks with domain expertise who want to be hooked up with technology. They know everything about their industry. They don't know anything about technology. And so we are able to bring them together with young technologists, and it's really, really exciting. So if you haven't been there, just to give you an idea, as I said, universities, venture funds, incubators in a whole bunch of different areas, schools of our own, seven or eight different schools, teaching literally hundreds and hundreds of students to be entrepreneurs and to start their own businesses. Just about every technology shop in the world is a part of 1871, and we get enormous support and help from them. But ultimately, you can't do this by talking about it. You actually have to put your head down and do the work. And the work that we're proudest of is we've graduated over 100 companies. They've raised close to $120 million. Now, this is capital that came into the city, into this economy that absolutely wouldn't have been there but for. And most importantly, they've created over 4,500 jobs. And jobs is really what drives the economy and what drives sort of the renaissance of what's going on in the city. In the U.S., we're number one. In the world, we're number four. The mayor constantly aggravates me about that, but we're moving forward. So that's a little bit about where we've been in the last couple of years. I want to talk to you now about change and about what's happening out there. And the first thing that's important to understand today in our lives is this idea of time and just how consequential time is. And time is, in fact, the scarcest resource. It's the thing that basically drives everything else. We have to make choices. And interestingly enough, today, size is an impediment. Size keeps you from being flexible. It keeps you from being agile, and it sort of weighs down your ability to be responsive. And so today what we like to say is if you're not in a big hurry, you're probably too late. Or sort of in the sports metaphor, think of a world where everything is overtime, because that's where we're at. That's the speed of global competition. That's what we deal with. And so just to give you a simple example, in the old world, the ad world, which is slowly dying before our eyes, if you were an agency, you might have three or four campaigns a year, and that might be a 90-day period, and you'd spend a couple of $1 million, and you'd build a campaign and pray. And today, if you did that, you would be insane, because today we get feedback, we get responses, we get information in real time. And so we change things in minutes, not in months. And this is starting to pervade everything. If you look at sort of the old world of television, which really is an old world that used to be driven by audience, and frankly, the nighttime news, about 22, 23 million people watch it, pretty good. In our world today, 1.04 billion people are on Facebook every single day. And so, sadly, the nightly news is probably not really news to much of anybody, but we wish him the best. And, you know, what's happening, though, that's also really important is that these new measurements permit us to do things that just were not possible before. So today you don't sort of buy a TV campaign, because we can do better than that. We know and can measure eyeballs. We can measure actually what people are doing out there. And so the ad world is going to change, and every business is going to have to say, look, I need my spend to make sense. I need to be able to explain and justify what I'm doing. And I want to be in a place where the agencies don't pretend that they are knowledgeable, that in fact, you know, the famous advertising guy John Wanamaker used to say half his advertising was wasted. He just didn't know which half. Well, today, it's sort of shame on you, because today we do know, and today we have the data to do it. And just to give you a simple example, this is sort of the world of yesterday, and it's the extent of which we had measurement and technology to permit us to understand that world. Here's the world today. It lets us look with degrees of particularity and specificity that changes everything, because now it doesn't look like a stable sort of business as usual world. It looks like a world that's driven by activity. This is also a world where you hear an enormous amount of bullshit, for better or for worse. So, you know, Skype is reporting that it has 1 billion registered users. You may know this guy, as a matter of fact. But the truth is only about 80 million of those folks. Sounds like a big number, except in our world. That's nothing in our world, but sounds like a big number. All of this is of a piece with an idea that's really important, and that is that data today is the most powerful and important thing that we have to deal with. We're going to look back in the not-too-distant future and say, my God, we had these tools, we had this information, and we really didn't take advantage of it. And so Measurement and data is changing everything. We can now intercept and change behaviors. We can do this all in real time. We can influence the consumer in a lot of ways. And so people think that the internet was about low cost and about speed, and certainly those are attributes. But what it was really about is a new ability that we have to hold everybody's feet to the fire, to make everybody accountable, to measure everything. And as you look out in the world today, whether it's education, whether it's healthcare, it really won't matter. Only two words will define sort of the future. And those words are very straightforward. One is transparency. It's a fair assumption that everybody will know everything about your business and what you're doing and about the competition and the competitive environment. And two, efficacy. They'll know how well you're doing. And if you're not doing really well, they'll go somewhere else because they have a virtually unlimited world of choice today. And so it's really important to sort of understand that. And we have new tools that let us measure the effectiveness of every kind of campaign, every kind of tool. And again, some of this seems trivial until you look a little bit inside. Now, this is a site that's called Hashtag Lunch. 35 million people, bizarre at this point, report what they had for lunch. I don't know if anybody here managed to do that, but if you haven't, your veal cutlet or your chicken really would appreciate your support. Now, here's what's interesting. This seems stupid and trivial, but when you data mine it, when you now say, well, what are these people eating and where are they and who are they eating with and what else are they doing and what kind of interest do they have, that's the story. We don't care about demographics. Demographics is sort of table stakes. It's a given. We know everything about you. What we're interested now in are what are your interests? Where can we motivate you? Where can we sort of reach you and change your behavior and influence your behavior? So today we spend in a new way. We don't spend money per se. We pay attention. It's the new currency. It's a really interesting thing. It's this another one of these very, very scarce resources. And so when people talk about sort of competition, this idea of we make time, this is Stretch Armstrong, I just like the image, but we make time for what we're interested in, and we're competing in this world, not against a set of competitions or competitors, but we're competing against everything that gets in the way of people and messaging and engagement and connection. And so that's the world that we're in today. To give you just some idea of scale and scope, 45,000 applications, new apps in the Apple Store in the last month. Okay, and in that kind of world, it's astonishing that we can find anything. It's astonishing that we can make any kind of intelligent decisions or anything like that. So what we do is we fall back on what we've always done, which is basically we fall back on habit. We fall back on what's customary and things that we've relied on in the past. So if you look at your own activities, you'll discover that on average you may explore a few things, but you're going to spend most of your time on less than half a dozen apps. And in fact, you'll spend 50% of your time on a single app. That's where we're at right now. Now, this attention thing is so challenging because these people have generally, I'm speaking about people under a certain age, that I don't want to offend a large number of the group here. Let's just say they have the attention of a flea. And if you don't believe me, I cite the Tic Tac. The Tic Tac people were so scared that people would be bored mid-suck that they basically changed the flavor of the Tic Tac. Now, this isn't even a lifesaver. This isn't a Tootsie Roll Pop. This is a friggin' Tic Tac, and they still felt we got to do something better and different. So, you know, this is a new world, and we used to rely on location. We used to rely on that. Today, we're fighting for attention. In the old world, it took maybe 7 contacts for a sales organization to reach prospects. Today, 3 times that. Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. So today we say that attention, which is this critical currency, has to be paid for. You have to make a deal with the consumer, make a deal with the customer. And the dimensions of that are pretty straightforward. The dimensions of that are really simple. Save me time, save me money, help me be more productive, a better decision maker, increase my status. Now, status didn't matter until about a dozen years ago. We knew it mattered, but what we didn't know and what was not possible in the world of the internet, which grew up as a world of anonymity and links. It connected us to other places, but it wasn't about people until Facebook came along about a dozen years ago. And Facebook came along, and now status is different. Status is something we can confer, we can publish, we can share. So not only is the world no longer in the situation where you can't be a cat or a dog, but status is going to change education, it's going to change healthcare, it's going to change motivations for employees, all of those kinds of things, badging, all of these new ways that we keep score, because that's what we do. Leaderboards are really important. We keep score. So, engagement. I mentioned before this issue of eyeballs. You know, eyeballs are not enough today. What we look for is the interesting issue that what you're saying sometimes is less important than the context in which you're saying it. We know this as parents, because as much wisdom as we're about to confer on our kids, if they're not listening, it's really sort of wasted. And so everything today is about how effective are your steps? How effective is your messaging? It doesn't matter whether you're a charity or a business or an institution, all the same. Are you reaching the right people? Is the message resonating with them? Is their behavior changing? Now, because of this new data, we can understand things that we didn't understand before. And I'll just tell you something about your behavior that you may not believe, but we know this for a fact. We've measured this. So, if in addition to not listening, how about if I'm not reading? Okay, and here's what we know today. Number one, we click on stuff, but then we don't bother to read it. Okay, this happens every single day in the trillions. Okay, number two, we share stuff that we haven't read. Why? Because let's make it somebody else's problem too. All right, that's really great. Number three is we never even go to the homepage anymore. We don't care. The app is the new homepage. So websites, way, way oversold. It's just not something that we're going to see going forward. The world is mobile. The world is portable. So this idea of content is very interesting. Context, very interesting. What it says at the bottom is this. You've got to figure out how to intelligently communicate with me if you want to be successful. So I like to say that it's not about tonnage. It's not about raising your voice or the noise. It's about improving your arguments. It's making that deal. It's making that intelligent connection with the consumer. We call that smart reach. Smart reach is really simple. It's like, create content for me that's engaging, that's relevant, that is delivered to me at the right time and place, and then maybe I'll pay attention to it. And what's so exciting is in Chicago, we have some of the great companies doing this now. Context Media is an example of a company that for patients gives them what they need, when they need it, wherever they are. Very, very exciting. They deliver information to patients in the waiting rooms of doctors. And frankly, the patients spend far more time with their videos than they do with the doctors. And that's because the doctors all have their heads in tablets now and they're trying to record the astonishing amount of information that they have to capture. So Context Media, one example of delivering the message in the appropriate context. Under Armour has found out some interesting things. If I catch you, and this is why they've invested $1 billion in fitness tracking technology, if I catch you right after a workout, you're super inclined to buy something. You're super inclined to buy athletic goods, which is, of course, what they sell. Or these folks track fashion, and what they've determined is that something north of 90% of the audience will post reading a blog make a purchase. Now that's very, very significant because that's saying that people react in the right context when they're in the zone. The trick is to be there when they're ready to buy. That's the whole thing. So the other part of that is this time sensitivity again. And I know this looks like sort of a, you know, labor poster or something like that. But what it stands for is just this world that we live in today of immediate gratification. And to give you again some idea of the scale, the masters of this are the game guys. The game guys are so on top of this that right now you can, while you're driving down the road and you see a billboard, or while you're watching TV, or while you're listening to anything, you can download and be playing one of these games in 120 seconds. no distribution costs, no anything. And this is the new world. And what's happening is this is building expectations in the consumer that all services, all businesses will be rendered in this kind of astonishing, speed-driven world. And it's because of the idea that we're all connected. The kids are beyond connected. Okay, the kids are connected like 100% of the time. But here's a flash, so are we. Now, I'll show you something. This says that 4 out of 5 of us check our phone within 15 minutes of waking up. The other 20%, they're just lying because we know that everybody checks their phone within 15 minutes of when they get up. But here's another staggering thing. We look at our phones 163 times a day on average. We have a tool that measures this, okay? Way more than that. Well, here's a flash. You spend more than 3.5 hours a day dealing with your phone, okay? And so it's just going to get worse. These, you know, bozos from the car business, okay, they're constantly telling us, and AT&T has been an enormous advocate of this, telling us, please don't text when you drive, and then they have 1,000 things to do in the car while you're driving, okay? You can do anything you want in the car, but by the way, pay attention just in case, all right? So, but cities are moving forward. Cities are going to have this ubiquitous connectivity, and that's going to permit all of us to be connected. In fact, right now, the numbers are pretty impressive. There's about, you know, 5.7 billion phones, and there's only about 7.4 billion people in the world right now. In fact, the truth is that there's more phones than toilets. You can decide what that means. But we're not paying by phone yet. This is really interesting. We have these devices. We learn a lot of information. But frankly, the conversion rates on phone transactions are going down. And there's a couple of reasons. One, again, you might not realize this, but the lion's share of phone use, mobile use, is still in the home, more than 70%, because we believe that that's a secure network environment. In addition, it's a pain in the ass to pay for anything on your phone, and so we haven't figured out how to eliminate that. Pretty soon we'll have universal checkout. Pretty soon we'll have one shopping cart, and wherever you go, you'll be able to execute these transactions. And the other thing is, it's still the case that the bigger the screen, the bigger the purchase. The major objects and things that we buy depend on the, again, the tools that we have. But time is going to be important. We're going to be able to pay for transactions by turning our phone around, and it'll identify our face. The Snapchat people, you know, a company sort of back from the dead, they've figured out that Snapchat users don't want to spend any time. I mean, if you want to be a friend of mine on Snapchat, you just take your phone and you take a picture of my little Snapchat tag, and it adds all that information. And that, again, is one of these things where the expectations are, no, there's no way in the world I'm going to fill out a form. There's no way in the world I'm going to look for all this information, especially redundant information. So the other thing that's happening is a really interesting thing that's changing our lives in sort of a special way. And that is that today things used to be about place, and now we can be every place all at once, and it's pretty exciting. So we started out as hunters and gatherers. This is for Professor Green. And the first revolution was about 10,000 years ago, and we started doing, you know, stationary farming, and, you know, place became a part of our lives in a very interesting way. You know, the way we start a conversation with virtually anybody is what? Where are you from? Where'd you go to school? You know, where do you live? All these things. Where do you work? And that was a real part of our lives. Now, today, place doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. Because time is what matters. And what's astonishing is that we can be anywhere and everywhere at the same time. So to really throw it back, you may recall the Roman Empire, okay? It fell, okay? I don't know if you know that. So here's what's really interesting. It fell for a lot of reasons. I think it fell because they didn't have cell phones. Now, if they had cell phones, they would have known that at the same time the Roman Empire was cooking along, there were two entire additional worlds that were adjacent. So the Chinese were out there with dynasties, and the Mayans were out there with cultures. And imagine today what that world would be like. Everything is shared in the moment. Everything is every place. And so it's just a different world. It's really exciting. So, you know, we used to go to the library. We used to get, you know, DVDs, all these kinds of things, all gone. All gone. And what does that mean? Well, what I'm most interested in is what does it mean for work? And so this idea of work is really exciting, because if time is essential, not place, it gives us the ability to pull people back into the workforce in really exciting ways. And we see this in 1871, where companies of 3 and 4 and 10 people might have 20 or 30 employees spread all over the world as resources for them, because they're now connected to them in really exciting ways. So we can take scraps of time. We can pull these things back. We can make the workforce broader and more effective. And people who are challenged in a variety of different ways can use these new services to rejoin the workforce. So whether they're stay-at-home moms or retirees or people who are stuck in a certain location, they can all now be effective. And so where we see this going is really interesting. First of all, already about 53 million people in the U.S. are freelancers. That's going to explode. We're going to see just more and more of that. We're going to see a whole new set of levels of commerce, of peer-to-peer transactions, of all kinds of things that are going to be super, super challenging for government, because they're almost impossible to regulate. They're almost impossible to sort of deal with. And so that's going to be a very exciting set of changes, exciting particularly for companies that are built to be global on day one, built to be connected, built to be mobile. That's all part of what we're building in 1871. And then here's another thing to think about. This is another one of these crazy, crazy things. The idea of trust, okay? First, we talk all the time about this. They call it the sharing economy. I call it the surplus economy, because what's really going on is we're not really sharing. What we're doing is saying that all of us have excess something. And so if we're an empty nester and we can help pay our mortgage by using Airbnb to rent out the kid's bedroom 3 times a month, we're going to do that, okay? And whether it's talent or resources or skills, all of those things, and we're all very happy to do that. We're all going to be contributing in new ways to sort of monetize our resources. But here's what's striking. This environment where you invite a complete stranger into your car or your house or whatever is enabled by trust and reputation. So we have built this system where we're perfectly comfortable, not all of us in every instance, but measurement and reputation and sharing of this information has created this new world where we trust strangers and we're willing to transact. Now, the journal that, you know, paragon of virtue and information, says we actually trust each other less. This is really interesting. But why, if we trust each other less, is this sharing economy exploding in so many different directions? Well, the interesting thing is we trust the crowd more than we trust each other. We think that the crowd is a source of such immense information and such reputational sort of credibility and things like that, that that's what's going on. So trust is going to be sort of a mutable idea. Reputation is going to be a very variable thing. And all of these are going to impact the way that we behave in different ways. I would think that that was my phone, but it turns out not to be my phone. Okay, so those are the drivers. Those are the things that we think are going to impact every business, the way we conduct our lives, the way we interact with institutions and things like that. Now, I want to talk about innovation just for a few minutes to explain sort of what we see as the necessity and the way that you have to deal with innovation. We are in a world where very little is going to be step by step, and very much is going to be big changes, jumps, things that are going to be the way we did it up to yesterday and never again. And just put a marker in the ground, because today is the day. Today is the day that technology is changing as slowly as it will for the rest of your life. Every single day going forward, the rate of technology will accelerate. It's autocatalytic, which means that every change makes the new change faster. And so we know change is coming. We're not sure where and everything that's going to change. I discovered just recently that one thing we know for sure is that these frigging voicemail systems all have changed their menu within the last 2 minutes. Is there any time you ever call that you don't get the message that says, by the way, our menu has changed, listen carefully? So that for sure we know. The rest of this stuff, not so much. I don't really know what to say. All right, so innovation. Well, what's going on? All right, first of all, let's understand it's not hard. What's hard is to give up what worked for us in the past, what we're comfortable with, what is habit-driven. That's hard. Number two is it's not that you can't change things. It's that you have to overcome the resistance. And then, as some of you know, I worked in the education space for a long time. And let me just say that it's easier to move a cemetery than it is to change the curriculum at a university, okay? So that's the world, but I get it. I get it. And so here's what we focus on. Here's what's important to us if you want to understand within your life, your organization, what innovation is all about. Seven pretty easy and pretty quick things. Number one, focus. You can do anything you want, you just can't do everything. And strategy is all about saying no. It's about being an aggressive editor. It's not being a mile wide and an inch deep. There are a few things that are really important, and there are a lot of things that are a giant waste of time. And, you know, this is what's really critical is that I think Confucius meant to say this. I'm not sure he did. It felt like a Confucian kind of thing. So I said it even if he didn't say it. But I do want to say one thing. I want you to tell all your kids this, that multitasking is a frigging lie, okay? It means basically that you're doing a lot of things badly all at once. Wow, you know, but let's understand that focus is really, really critical, and it's essential. Now, having said that, one of the exciting things, one of the amazing things is that kids today under a certain age are in fact born with two brains, okay? They actually have their regular brain, and then they have this astonishing tool that provides them decision-making capacity and information and helps them in so many ways. And that's the world we're going to have to deal with. But fundamentally, it's important to explain to them that it still matters and it's still important to pay attention. Number one. Number two, start now. Get started. Basically, waiting by and large doesn't make things better. The world is moving too quickly. Nobody waits for you. All of the innovation that's going on is critical. Now, it helps to know where you're going. Speed is, as it turns out, not a huge advantage if you don't know where you're headed, okay? That may surprise you, but so we say you need a roadmap. Now, this might have been called mail flicks, okay, because for the first umpteen years, what happened? They sent around DVDs in those red envelopes. But the truth is, he had a vision. He had a vision of where it was going, and that's what is really important. I want to take a minute to sort of talk about lean startups. You're going to hear a lot of this. Everybody knows the term. We think it's a stupid term. And the reason we do is because it's, you know, it's fomented by this idea that you just sort of throw anything against the wall and what sticks is what's good. That's not a good strategy, because in this world, it's a little different. First of all, we adopt things very rapidly, very, very rapidly, but we throw them away even faster. You know, one use is typical. 70, 80% of the applications that are out there, a single use, then gone. So number two is you better hit it out of the park on day one, because the consumer has so many choices and other ways to spend their time and their attention and their energy that if you don't do it right, it's not going to happen at all. And so it's really important to understand that. And number three is, and this happens every day at 1871, we have people that are inventing the cure for no known disease and wonderful solutions for problems that they hope will be out there somewhere. So one of the things that's important to understand is that what we want to do is fall in love with the problems. We have intractable, you heard, significant problems, okay? We want to solve them. But it's going to take a while to get there, okay? And it's going to take a bunch of different ideas and experiments and trials. And they wouldn't be experiments if we knew they were going to work. So we say fall in love with the problem, not the solution. And that's really, really critical. And there's a right way to do this, by the way. The right way to do it is, first of all, you find out what people need, okay? And you do the research. And it's really hard. It's easy to sit there and code something, because people will, you know, give you a lot of Mountain Dew and pizzas, and you can just keep your head down and code your brains out, right? But it's hard to go out and to call on 50 customers and ask them if this is a real need, if this is a real issue for them. So when you find those customers and you determine that they value what you're trying to build or what you hope to build and that they'll pay for it, because there's an infinite demand for people who say, well, if it was only blue, I'd buy three, okay? Or, you know, there's an infinite demand for the unavailable. But the truth is that you need to find a real market, a real need. And by the way, if they're in pain, then they become forgiving. Then they're willing to experiment with you because you're getting there, and they become supporters instead of critics. Very, very critical. And then you launch a product, and then you go crazy iterating it every day. This is a life strategy, by the way. This is not limited to businesses. This is how athletes improve. This is how everything improves, because we get a little bit better every time, every day. And we do that by doing it. And that's the way you get better. And it's important to understand the way the world is as well, which is whatever worked perfectly for the consumer yesterday, too bad. They don't really care, okay? Because that bar keeps rising. And if you're not cannibalizing your business, and if you're not raising the bar, someone else is. A competitor, somebody to do it faster or cheaper or more broadly. There's a zillion ways that people compete today. Number three, aim high. You know, we think that there are a zillion people. It's hard to be an entrepreneur. It's hard to change things. It's hard to invent the future. So there's plenty of people that'll tell you what you can't do and all the reasons that you can't do it. We don't think that looking around is the way to benchmark the world. We think that you have to look forward. And so, you know, we don't look around and say, well, it worked for them and that's a good solution. We say, what's possible? And what can we do as we go forward? And so we have a rule. Now, you know, Jay Doherty would always say there's no bad seat at the City Club. I sort of believe that. But the idea is, if you don't ask, then shame on you. There's always a best option, and you should go for it. And if you do, if you raise the bar, if you keep raising the bar, those of us of a certain age understand this. Now, at the same time, you know, each of these things that we deal with are really interesting, because the traditional, the conventional wisdom is just so hard to deal with in this changing world that we deal with. So we tell people to be patient. They're like, that's insane. That's insane. We have to run around completely like crisis mode and as chickens with their heads cut off. But that's not really true. Even if you know exactly where you're going, it's going to take three times longer and cost twice as much. That's just the rule of the world, okay? So we tell people to remember the slinky, remember momentum, remember that early adopters aren't enough. Get it right first and then grow it. And if it's a huge problem, take it a bit at a time. Keep moving it forward. Do a little something that you can accomplish. You know, we talk about this all the time. You want to encourage your people to have successes, successive successes, getting a little bit better, really, really critical. So it's important to always have a vision, to be excited about a solution that you're going to build, things that you're going to change. But you have to understand that change in your own organization, in your own, you know, opportunities is very much a fluid thing as well. So keep the goal in mind, but, you know, understand that you need to be flexible. Mistakes are something that we talk about a lot as well. A couple of things that are significant about this idea of mistakes. You have to have a tremendous tolerance for it. It's embarrassing. You're going to make mistakes. What we try to do at 1871 is have our companies not make the same mistakes more than once, make their own mistakes, not make mistakes that we can take out of the equation, which we do increasingly with these mentors. So we think that we're really good and we're raising the odds of success. We want 1871 to be a place you come because it makes the prospects of your business being successful much more substantial. And that's the goal. Now, this mistake thing is a couple of different things. Part of it comes from professional athletes, and they have an idea that's called in-game amnesia. And all that means very simply is, if I'm looking over my shoulder at the last call, the last putt, the last anything, I'm not paying attention going forward. So this is critical. This is really, really critical to look ahead. And Steve Jobs, who was a friend of mine, hated it when I called him a great liar, but he was a great liar. And what he would do the day after he would change his mind, we could have been doing something for 2 years and he would still say, tough, you know, we're changing. And then he would deny that we were ever doing it the old way. And you know, when you would press him, when you would show him videos, you know, written documents, Steve, you know, we were doing this yesterday. The paint is not even dry. You know, he would say basically an interesting thing. He would say, I'm doing what's right for the business today. And that's the moment that we live in. That's the way this goes. You can't deal with sunk costs. You can't deal with being embarrassed because a change is critical to building what you want to build. So this idea of doing what is the best decision, the best choice today is really, really critical. You know, mistakes are these interesting things. You know, nobody's going to be perfect, but they're just part of the game. And as I said before, you have to get used to that. We understand that, and we sort of get that. But what's really interesting is many, many years ago when I started out my first business, I had been a lawyer for about 10 years, and the first five or six venture funds said, you know, we don't invest in lawyers. And I'm like, is it a racial thing? I don't understand. Is it a group of things? I mean, what is it? Are they complete scumbags? I don't know. So it turned out that they didn't, because lawyers thought that they had to always be right. They were much more focused on the precision and not on winning the game. And these guys said, look, we're in it for the money. We want to win. We understand that things are going to go wrong. There are going to be problems, all these different things. But it's really important to understand that mistakes don't end it. You know, you have to have a process around mistakes. You have to sort of make it. You have to learn from them. And, you know, the fact is we encourage that because that's sort of the entire process of iteration is all about mistakes. You know, we have this education system, and it's tough and it's challenging for kids. And kids today, it's so heartbreaking, say the most boring place they go is often school. But they play games like crazy. Now, here's the deal. 80% of the time when you're playing a game, you're failing. That's how the math works. That's how games are built. But you keep playing because you're getting a little bit better. You're reaching the next plateau. You're accomplishing something. It's very, very concrete. If we said 80% of the kids in our classes and schools were failing, they would drag us out and shoot us. But we have to figure out how to bring those two things together, how to bring that ownership and that control and that building together with education, or we're never going to solve these really serious problems. The other thing that we try to do at 1871 that's very significant has to do with blame. And what we found is that basically if you blame someone else for your problems, what you do is you give up your own power. You give up your ability to make change happen. And so we don't play the blame game. I mean, we have an understanding that we do blame people for just two things, okay? And this is from the president of Lego. If you don't ask for help, or if you don't give help, then shame on you, and we'll blame you for that. But we're not going to blame anybody for stubbing their toe. We're not going to be blaming anybody for taking their best shot or trying things, because if you do that, you kill the whole culture. And our culture is sort of a healthy culture in that sense. We tell people all the time, just fail fast, okay? Just understand the most critical part of this process is basically that, you know, it's not about failing. It's about, did you think it through? If we didn't want you to try new things, you wouldn't be here. Now, it's a different thing to say you gave up. Okay, giving up is different from basically failing. And so we want people to have permission to fail within our organizations, but we don't dwell on it. In venture capital, we have something called the J curve. And it's pretty clear that things are going to get worse in most businesses one way or another before things get better. That's perfectly fine. The other thing we say all the time about rejection, because perseverance is as critical a skill for entrepreneurs as anything, is this. We say it's only a no for now. And what that means is keep asking, okay? If you don't ask, the answer is always no. It's always no. So whether Michael Jordan said, you know, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take, or whatever the circumstances are, it's about standing up every time you fall down, and in fact, standing up one more time, you know, because you want to be ahead of the game. And so opportunity cost is really crucial. And one of the things that we do, people ask all the time, how are our companies doing? Our companies are doing amazingly well. Some of them aren't the same companies that they were when they came in. But that's part of the course, okay? What we try to do is basically say that if you're going the wrong way, if you're digging a hole, stop digging, okay? And we can improve what's going on. My wife is going to hate this slide. But the idea is to tell people that their baby is ugly and basically to move on and to change things. Sorry, I'm already getting a dirty look. So the truth is, here's what we should be afraid of. Here's what's really critical, okay? What's really important and what you should be afraid of is doing something that doesn't matter, okay? So when people come into 1871, it's one of the first tests. It's how are you going to make a difference? How is what you're trying to build going to matter to something more than you, beyond yourself? How is it going to impact others beyond you? That's what we want to do. We want to create that environment. We have a tremendous number of talented people. Turns out one of the most important things to do is keep other people out of their way. Okay, now these are talented people. Those are package deals. These are people who don't necessarily believe that bathing is an essential daily skill, okay? Or who want to work all night or who do different things in their own way. You have to make room for them. You can't build a business successfully in your own image. You just can't do that. You need all kinds of different people. And so the people in 1871 have some very clear, very simple sort of criteria. They want to work with other talented people. They want to work on important problems that are going to change things. And they want to be sort of proud of the work that they're doing and be recognized for it. And so, you know, when you are in this environment and people are talking about Teslas or big cars or stuff like that, that's not really what's most important. What's astonishingly important is to be able to get up every day and go to some place where you can be enthusiastic about what you're doing and work with people who are equally challenged but also equally excited about what's going on. So when we define success, what we say is this. You have to like yourself. You have to like what you're doing, and you have to like how you're doing it. Those are two different things, and that's really critical. And so that's the world that we're building. That's what we're excited about at 1871. Two last things. You have to love Chicago and love the City Club. So thank you very much.
You went a little long, but he was on a roll. And
long?
I was keeping time on my new app. 16 years old and still ticking. Few people remember John Cameron Swayze, right? A couple of geezers, all right. All right, we have a question from Dave Lundy. Aileron, this is a perfect question for you, Howard. Do we have any other questions that are not text? All right. Is privacy as we know it dead? How can we balance security encryption battle such as was on vivid display with Apple versus the FBI?
Okay, thank you. Thanks, Dave, for an easy question. I would have preferred, what do you like for dessert? So I think privacy is dead. I think that that's really depressing. But, you know, one of the examples I always give when people ask about, you know, shared medical information is if you were laying in the street and the paramedic needed to have information about you so that he didn't inject you with something that killed you because of an allergy or a condition that you had, would you rather they have it or not have it? And I think the answer is most of us, for convenience, for speed, for time, we're making these trades all day long every day of giving up degrees and extents of our information. And we do it because we're trading. And, you know, now, kids, I think, don't get that at all. They don't understand you can't un-Google yourself. I mean, and they don't understand what they're trading. At Flashpoint, way back when, we used to tell our freshman students, please don't put your first work on the internet because, God forbid, somebody will see that and it completely sucks and we don't want them making a decision based on that, but, you know, that didn't keep them from doing it at all. So I think that, you know, technology is always neutral. I think that it's going to depend on what we do and how we regulate it. But I think that kids under a certain age have no expectation of privacy, and I think they don't care. I think that they live in a culture where sharing is more important than any privacy concerns or anything else. And as far as the Apple encryption thing goes, I think that, you know, technology is never ultimately what adds value. What adds value is, you know, substance and creativity and things like this. The technology will always be outdated, superseded, available to everybody, you know, ubiquitous. So I don't think that that's a technology issue. I think it's just a question of is the government, for reasons that have to do with whether it's terrorism or crime or things like that, entitled to certain amounts of information? And the courts will decide that. I don't think the companies are going to decide that. And I think that ultimately, if push came to shove, that case would probably have been decided against Apple. I think everybody feels that way.
Okay. Good answer. Before I give you the ultimate softball closer, and since you were so kind to higher education, is Larry Epley in the audience?
He is. I see him right there.
Yeah, Larry, former chairman of the University of Illinois Board of Trustees. Don't forget what he said. That didn't work. Okay.
I'm not sure I said anything bad. I mean, he's my...
The cemetery, you know, and the curriculum.
Oh, that.
Change. Yeah.
Oh,
some of us caught that.
I've lived with much worse than that.
He leaves no stone unturned. Okay. Tara, was it Shocker, Spock? I can't...
Okay, I got the answer. So the answer is, if you send an email to h@1871.com, we'll give you a version of the presentation.
He'll give you a version of it.
Right.
How about a round of applause?
Okay, thank you. Hold on.